could call it that, of prayer, and sees that in terms of the genius of the individual. As men's prayers or disease of will, so are their creeds, or disease of the intellect. And traveling, all men, so does our spirit of society, you see? Spirit of society. Now that's just the general term, society. And he talks about property there amongst other things. Now, I still think it would be useful to you on a piece of paper just to put the what's good for the genius on one side and what is bad for it on the other. As you go through this essay, I think that much system on your part will, you'll see more clearly, you'll feel more what he's trying to do. He doesn't think of opinions, you see. You don't find opinions in Emerson. See, none of this is opinion. He doesn't deal in opinions, you see. Let's run through the American scholar. Now, you see, along about this time is when people start getting mad at me. You know, I'm not Emerson. Don't get mad at me. You don't get mad at me. All right, don't get mad at me now. You just, what are you asking me? Can't anyone raise a question without having to answer the darn thing? We have a couple of months ahead of us, don't we? Not even a month. What? You mean you're going to stop thinking as soon as you get through Emerson and start all over again? What does Thoreau think about opinions, for instance, and society and all like that? The American scholar is a very helpful thing. He rides a national feeling. It's like the robins going on up north at Valentine's Day. There's always these huge currents of air moving north, and all they've got to do is spread their wings and ride it up there. I've seen them do it. They come in any time during the day and night. One day they may not be there, and the next morning they're all there. They've ridden that blast, you see. Now, he's doing that on this national feeling, this nationalism, I don't know just what you'd call it. As he says here, our day of dependence, our long apprenticeship to the landing of other lands draws to a close. You see, we have been dependent on Europe, on England in particular. We have had that colonial attitude. In England, you see, writes the books and ships them over here. And a year or two later, we read what's old by that time over there. The millions around us that are rushing into life cannot always be fed on the sere remains of a foreign harvest. Events, actions arise that must be sung, that will sing themselves. Now, that's it. Now he uses this fable, and what he wants to say is just about what he wanted to say before, except he takes it a little differently, you know. The difference between man thinking You know, a man thinks in so many ways that really, 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 it's awfully unfortunate, you know, it's awfully unfortunate that there's not more words, and all this use of the mind has to go under the one term, thinking. The thinking is so, so different. And you see what he does here. And now, the whole paper, you see, will show that. Now, he calls this the American Scholar. This is a Phi Beta Kappa address. But he does something here he's done before. What does he do to the word genius? He takes it from Shakespeare to each one of us. Now, those few who are chosen for the Phi Beta Kappa, or the honorary societies. The term here is extended, you see, to all of us who use our mind at all. In this view is man thinking, you see, the theory of the office contained. Him nature solicits at all her, him the future invites. It is not indeed every man a student, you see, a scholar. And do not all things exist for the student's behoof. So that here is the American scholar. Any American, you see, who proposes to be, well informed, know what's going on. And what he proposes to do here is say what makes that American scholar. How, what influences are the best influences for him? Now, he says, you see, three things here, and it sounds as if he's being systematic, but it's not. Nature, he didn't say much about nature here. It's more against nature here than it is for it. Nature he puts first. And in Emerson's time, you see, there was more open country in the world than there was settled country. And wild. But there's plenty of it now for anyone who sees it. Then in the middle of that long paragraph, he says what is not nature, and that's classification. Now, is that his opinion? He's not talking about things on which there are opinions in this. Classification. But I'd say the weakest part of the essay is what he says about nature. There's much to say, he can't say much. He's already written this long, first famous thing he did was this long essay on nature, which I'd advise you not to read. It's got everything in it, and you can't make anything out of it. And we won't use nature in this course, very little. I don't know how we can work it in. We'll try. Now, the past. And what does he equate with the past? Books, and he says some right illuminating things about books. I don't want to go into those with him. What do books give you? What do you read books for?
He says that you should read books for 5 years,
well, now, most people would say, what do you read books for? For knowledge, don't you? Knowledge. Is that right? Yes. Yes. No knowledge. See where he talks about knowledge here. And then think of it in your own terms. Let me tell you. You can bring this, you can test it this way. How would the instructor present Emerson? According to Emerson's own theory of books, or according to some theory of books that Emerson thinks poorly of? In other words, would the instructor say to find out as much as you can about Emerson and his reading? The books he read, That's knowledge. Or, are you supposed to read books as Emerson proposes to read books? Well, now somebody has to decide that question. Of course, you might compromise it a little bit. Knowledge, by and large, hinders thought. But I think most people would welcome that substitution. I'm going to give you a little quiz on Emerson one of these days. I'll ask you such questions as this. What's an Emersonian view of books? I don't want negative answers altogether. I want the positive questions too. I see. I'm just slightly holding the stick above you. And this one. Now you've got a long ways to go on this. And number three, action. Action. You see, the scholar has to do. He has to be all those things too, you know. And not just a bookish man, but he's got to be. Now that'll give you something to think about. And what life is. You see, you can get a job almost anywhere. Now, say a secretary at one of these business offices down there, and you get along fine. Go to the picture show and buy nail polish and new shoes. Now, is that life? Is that action? There may be more, what's the word, withdrawal there than at Walden Pond. Oh, there's so many of these things. Now he has this how to read, you see, what he calls creative reading. Now I'll skip over just a little bit. He talks about the duties of the scholar. You see, at the break, I have not spoken of the education of the scholar, but books, it remains to say something of his duties. They are such as become man thinking. They may be all comprised in self-trust. Office means responsibility or duty. Office scholar is to cheer,
overall parameters of the student in order that they'll be happy in life.
Yes. Now you see the last part, the signs of the time, as he calls it. The signs of the time. Now he talks about second thoughts. He actually uses the term, you see. And a little farther down, he says one of these signs is of the lowest class in the state. And then instead of the sublime and beautiful, the near, the low, the common is to be explored. Instead of the sublime and the beautiful, it's the near and the common that is to be explored. I ask not for great, remote, to romantic, what is going on in all these places. I embrace the common. I explore and sit at the feet of the familiar. But you notice the term explore. And then when he said, whoso would be a man must be a nonconformist. He who would gather mortal palms must not be hindered by the name of goodness, but must explore if it be goodness. So the term explore may be then what he's doing in his whole self-reliance essay. And here it's a little different viewpoint. Can you see the two essays now as a little different inquiry? Now, the Divinity School address is an application of Emersonian thought to one situation. It is his way of life in action. And this is the supreme case of nonconformity on his part, and after that he didn't nonconform anymore. Now, next time, I want you to have in your mind this Emersonian viewpoint. Gather it up a little bit. See Thoreau in those terms, but principally the Scarlet Letter. Most of you have read it half a dozen times. It's short. I'll assume that you read it next time. I'm going to ask you to write in class, not to be graded on, but just for my information. I want you to tell me what the usual view of the Scarlet Letter is. Just the usual view of the meaning of the Scarlet Letter. An Emersonian view of it. View it in terms of Emerson and Thoreau. And that may get a little closer to it, you see. Whole history could be different. If 100 years or so ago, the first readers of Franklin's autobiography could have said, this is not all of Franklin. This is just one small side of it. They didn't say that. They magnified this side of prudence. Now it would be good. Our whole history might have changed. Well, not that important. This book's not that important. Let me finish that sentence. What I was struggling with there is to say that with all our devotion to the Scarlet Letter for a century, it may be that our reading of it is precisely the opposite of what Hawthorne is saying in the Scarlet Letter. Now, this is the Scarlet Letter, the first day of discussion, and I'm going to line it out for them before they take a little test. It's not really a test, it's just something to get it down on paper and impress it on their minds so that when they look back at it, they'll see how far off they were. John, we could talk a little bit about Scarlet Letter. As you write, or before you write, just to sort of line it out. What's the first view you get? First scene is the women sort of introducing her, and she's going to appear before the town in judgment, kind of what happens. The judgment's already been passed. Oh, that's right, isn't it? And she's actually coming out to serve her sentence, you might say. That's right.
I just wouldn't sit there and do that. I'd go ahead and get it out of my lips. It's not worth it.
Yes. Leniency of it. They could have given her the death penalty, but they didn't, yes.
Well, she would be more valuable to the community.
Examples in the community?
But I mean, this is when the children were telling about her and all, you know, as she walked through the street, and they didn't really know exactly, you know, what she had done. Here's the first, it's not the trial, that's already taking place, but the sentence. And that's in the pillory, on the, what do you call it, on the scaffold. Now what does that lead into? The scaffold. And there her husband returns. I remember that. Now where you go? You skip, don't you? I believe you skip. Don't you skip a good bit of time?
Yeah.
How much time do you skip? Where do you skip to? Oh, yes. And that's at the governor's mansion. Am I wrong? Oh, yes.
He planned to find out who the father of Purple was.
Yes. Yeah. That's right. That's all right there together. Now, any more in this first episode? He appears on the scaffold and then goes to the jail. Yes.
Isn't that a skip? I mean, has Tristan Page talking about Hester's life after she moved out of the cottage? I mean, how, when she passes through the streets and all, everyone, you know, the children
laughing, point at her and so on, too. Mm-hmm.
And just talks about the loneliness of her days.
Yes. Got to allow her a little time. Yes.
There was one thing there.
What chapter is that? The minister's chastiser, upbraider, on the scaffold, yes. Well, now you see, we're bringing out that scene. I'm glad we started on that. It's a lot of that to skip my mind. Yes. Yes. Oh, he's one of the ministers that does that, isn't he?
The older minister tells Arthur to talk with her, persuade her to come back to the other person.
Now, let's see. Chapter 5, then. Hester at her needle. That's part. Beginning maybe at chapter 5, Hester and her needle. Now, this is Hester, and she's had time now to settle down out there in the cottage. And whatever you say about this will be interpretation, won't it? Except that it says here that she settles down and makes a living with a needle. What else does it say that happened, actually happened? Karen? Now that's interpretation, isn't it? Yeah. Now in the... It's almost pure interpretation. Now in the first section we've been talking about is mostly incident. Well, a large part incident. And now it looks like it turns at her, looks at Hester. Hester Needle. Oh, look over there. I'm just looking for ways of dividing it up. I've never looked at it closely, you know. And then chapter 13. Another view of Hester. When does that take place? That's more time elapses. So she's been out there 7 years. Yes. Well, now look at here. Look at here. Now, I'm not prepared to say this, but I wish you'd look at it. You're better at these things than I am, and you've got it in your mind better than I have. It looks to me like there are three incidents, divisions or something. Chapter 5 would be the second one, and then chapter 13, 12 and 13. The 13 is a reaction to 12. As I remember, she sees the minister, you see, in his weakened state. And that prompts her to some sort of action, and maybe in this third part there is some more incident, action. Anyhow, let me tell you. What I would ask you to do for tomorrow, check that. I'll check it too, and let's see if it'll divide up like that. You have to sort of lay it out in the structure of it before you can actually, you know, get a hold of it. And let's say there are three views of Hester. The first one. And then in chapter 5, and then in chapter 13, I say three views, at least the view changes, or Hester changes. Call it whatever you like. Now, don't try to handle that today. Now, I want you to, have we done enough on the incident, or you want to do a little bit more on the incident? Hester the needle, and then she goes to they want to take the child away, and she goes to the governor's place, and then Hester, 7 years later, after she's been there 7 years, and that is, look at that briefly, and let's see what happens, if you don't mind, if you would. That's the you might say that. Is there such a word as climax? Turning point's better. Turning point, yes. Yes. Now after that, is there anything, any incident in particular we need to bring up? Now, what does that procession have to do with it all? The election day. Yes. That's over towards the end, isn't it? And, that's when they were going to flee, run away, and just have a clean slate. Yes, yes. And what about that, you remember the sermon that, okay, let's let it go at that now, and write about just the usual interpretation of Scott's letter, and then you can start all over again. I'll give you a little warning and make a Emersonian view of it. You'll let me have this piece of paper as you leave. Just leave it here on my desk. And then on another sheet of paper, if you make just a few notes, just a sort of a plan of operations, Now I'll talk to you while you're writing. And I want you to make notes of this. I want you to make notes now of what I'm saying to you. This is the plan of attack. I told you now on this second part, if when you take a look at it from an Emersonian view, now some of you are not listening to me and are not taking notes on what I'm saying to you. I want you to do that and not keep on writing. I want this sheet you've just written, but I want you to take these notes on your own paper. Keep it. I said to you now, as you were writing, that this second part of it, where you take a kind of look at the story from an Emersonian view, I didn't want you to make an effort to get to the final answer and be too serious or systematic about it. I just wanted you to begin to look at it in that light and let that Emersonian view sort of enter your mind. And then I said to you, if your memory had a retrospective side to it, well, that's contradictory, but if you could remember how your mind shifts, how your attitude shifts from one little position to another, you would find this fascinating, I think. Now, next time, you can kind of use these broad terms. Say there are three views of Hester, as we said at the first part today. That first episode incident in which we see her, the sentence carried out. And then in chapter 5, where she has settled down at the cottage. And then in chapter 13, after 7 years. I'm right encouraged. I think that's going to be useful. But don't neglect now, don't forget to examine these three parts to see if it does actually separate like that. I'm sort of depending on you. Now you're not setting down what I told you. I want you to set these down. I don't want to trust your memory. I don't want you to trust your memory, you see. I don't even trust you now to remember those three parts. I want you to use those three parts and take three different views of Hester. And I don't want you to toy with that. I want you to be serious with that. I don't care what views you take, but I want you to look at her in three stages. And don't play around with that. Now, is that firm enough? Now let me show you a basic contradiction. We don't have time. Our usual view of it is that it's a Puritan story. And we see a case here of a brother's keeper where it's a little cruel and vengeful. Unsympathetic, you see, to the person who has violated the code. Then she is resigned, you might say, to the Puritan way of life. She conforms to the Puritan way of life. Then she is forgiven in time, you see, and actually accepted as a model and interpretation of the A. You see, is different. It goes from one thing to love, you see, adultery to love. Now, let me tell you, you know that Emerson is not going to write a story in praise of resignation and conformity. He's not going to write a story that will conform to the old 17th century Puritan view of morality. Now you know that. Now you're faced, I'm going to follow you now. I can lay it out, but you see, I have limitations. I've got to live with myself within my limitations. I think it'd be downright sinful for me to raise a question and answer it, you know, when I'm not too sure of the answer. But you have to get the Emersonian view in a shape where you can handle it. Now let me show you
how that works out.
It is conformity to society. Now that's one of his big points. You see, it is a he says consistency is not a virtue. And he says that property is a hindrance as he sees it or as he presents it. And he says the genius or that inner light is something. Now you see, you can go through those articles, essays. I went through them in part with you. And I hope that you would go through them ahead, go ahead through them. But now, I don't believe this can be examined but just point by point. I think one of these has to come first. And I don't think it's the attitude towards society that comes first. I don't think that is basic. I think we have to have something coming first that will embrace all the others, all these other incidental points that he makes. And in that, you've kind of forgotten this now, but I think you'll have to follow what I told you about, and I told you that I had read that Emerson spent his life raising the question or examining or exploring the individual, what he calls the genius. That is the life of the individual, what makes the individual alive. Now these other points are important, but they have to fit in underneath that. Now you start from that punch and see if that won't help you. And leave those little pages on my desk. Now, thank you very much. I enjoyed the session. Now, this is the second day of Hawthorne coming up. I don't think I got very much down. The tape broke. But I'll put down what I got. Now, those papers you wrote last time, they didn't mean much to you, but they helped me a great deal. We are involved in several of the writers now, and the meaning of Thoreau and Emerson and Hawthorne is sort of we're holding off now. The proposal was that I would work with you on this and not lecture to you and give you any set of answers. That means that one of the foremost, you see, of the American writers, Emerson, who had a system of thought, that we have to get into that thought and get it straight, and then look at another writer from that point of view. Now, I think the best way of approaching this is to some of the comments. This is the usual view of the Hawthorne. Hester is presented as a strong, determined woman who accepts her fate and lives on. One can't help but respect her more and more with the passing of time. She overcomes the initial blow of her punishment. Her courage is shown in many ways. Her unique method of embroidering her letter on her clothes, the way she chooses the dresses she chooses for Pearl, in a style that's inappropriate for the Puritan's tradition, her determination to earn money to support herself, and several other things. Now that's, I thought, pretty well put down. Now what that amounts to is, that is Hester, from the point of view of Franklin, self-reliance. Now, if you say that Emerson and Thoreau are in another tradition, then this cannot be acceptable interpretation of Hawthorne's book. We will not look in there for lessons in self-reliance and the sense of perseverance and of character building. I see what's at stake. You see what's at stake. Almost, whether or not a whole branch of literature will be retained as a part of our reading and our civilization, you might say. If we're going to look at one of the so-called transcendentalist writers and get out of him the same lessons we get out of Poor Richard, then the whole purpose of the novel, fiction, literature has collapsed.
Now let me read you another point or two. Hawthorne clearly takes the side of Hester Prynne, not so much as condoning her for her actions, but by creating a character that had the strength to rise above her neighbors despite the damning symbols which she wore. Now, in this context, that is the same as I've just read you. That's viewing Hester in terms of self-reliance. Now, there's some more there I won't read you. Now, here's another point. I do not think that Emerson would condemn Hester for what she had done. He talks about a man doing what he himself thinks is right and not accepting everything that is imposed by society. Now, that is a dangerous application of Emerson. Now, that's taking self-trust and not violating one's nature into a dangerous area. That's almost putting Emerson in the position of condoning sin, error, you see, in this case, adultery. Almost. Now, he believed that people must trust their own thoughts, be true to themselves, be nonconformist. Applying these principles to Hester Prynne of Scarlet Letter, she acted as she should act. She and Arthur Dimmesdale acted in a manner true to their thoughts. Now, you're getting in dangerous territory. That's condoning sex. Unless I have something to go on. You see, I just stand up here and talk. And I took all that time last night. I asked you to take all that time last night and write these. I didn't read these systematically. I read a good many of them. And I marked passages. I'll use some more passages if it occurs to me. Now, you see the... to me... that what we are faced with is, now we've raised the question, and I think any instructor wants to raise the question, and you've read the material. How well, I don't know if you've read it. I think now it's almost inevitable for the instructor to pick up these cues and then give you some lecture notes. And that will resolve the difficulty. And we can go on to the next, follow the syllabus. Oh, I see so much of that. I see so much of that. You see, so much of that. An example doesn't come to my mind right now. Yes, I think of one, but it would take me too long to say that. Now, here's another thing that takes place. I ask you this time to focus on three points, episodes, passages. Now, we'll talk about those, and we'll get into those just in a half second. if I could be sure you would had time in your mind to examine some of these points I bring before you or rise in our discussions. Actually, now, I'm not bringing this before you. It just comes out. Thinking about a novel very often is not really about the novel. It's about the plot. Now, let me tell you. You can get a little 2 or 3 page summary, or you can pay a dollar and get a chapter by chapter summary of any of these books. And you can write a fine paper on a novel and never look at a novel. That won't be any good. You see, you'll be using the plot. Now look. Just as we worked it out last time, I thought, with your help, I thought, with you doing most of the work, I thought we did pretty well last time. Here's the first view of Hester. The court has already passed, made a decision on it, and she comes out to face the sentence. Now, actually, we didn't say one significant thing about Hester last time that I can remember. Not one. Hester herself, as she faces this sentence, we didn't even mention. So you just remember what we said last time and just take my word for it, that is superficial and had no meaning whatever. We were talking about the plot. And sometimes I'll tell you the truth. Unless I read a book on a book or a good article, I don't know whether I'm getting into the book or just talking superficially. Let me tell you. The freshmen have one of their cultural events this time, this second term. It's the play that they saw in the movie last time, that in that fierce thing on Revolution. What was that called? The Marassade, yes. Now, I saw it, and I didn't know what it was about. And I had 2 or 3 speeches or discussions in my freshman classes. And, you know, they made 1 or 2 statements, and then they withdrew. They wouldn't say another thing. And I don't think they knew. I'm not sure. A lot of times they know more than I think they know, and know more than I know. Now that's true. I'm not just being kind to them. Now this, I think the play will make more of it than the movie. I think we'll come closer to understanding what goes on in the play form than we did in the movie. But I tell you, I'm looking around for an article on it. Freshmen can read it if they want to, but at least I can read it and have a little better notion of what goes on in it. Now, what I think we ought to do is get into, I've raised a question with you now about this book. And I think somebody ought to write an article on it. And that'd be our contribution, you see, to future classes or future discussions. Somebody, see, get a view. Now, let me tell you. Let's take this second view of Hester. You look at chapter, 5? Now, let's look at Hester from the point of view of chapter 5.
They said, well, we...
That's where it broke. Now, that's where the tape broke, and we went into the chapter 5 and picked out the details and tried to put them together. This is Friday, the first full test on Emerson and the Scarlet Letter.
Almost of our literature. Not as much as Franklin's autobiography. Not as much as Poor Richard. Not nearly as much.
But it just, for some reason or other, it just retains that place on all reading lists. Now, I don't want to underestimate your ability, but if I may judge at all from my experience, it is extraordinarily easy to basically misread. And the experience I have, most places I go where I can talk about these things, I don't know, the talk is really never basic. Seems like it's just superficial in spite of everything. For one thing, nobody gets to talk long enough, say in an interpretation of Hester or the Arthur Dimmesdale, to actually give a picture. No one ever has the floor long enough. You see, his... It's all sort of jabbing away. Now look, in the hospital, you see, the doctors and the nurses just can't operate that way. They've got to have more accuracy. In the war in Vietnam, they just simply have to have more intelligence of where the enemy is, you see, and what forces they have to dispose against the enemy. They just have to. And we go ahead with these masterpieces. And I think it's just a basic misreading of them. Now look. You haven't had a chance to get into this. I'll give you the chance now. But in those papers that you wrote on Monday, they helped me a good bit. I could see a fluctuation that somehow sort of disturbed me. I gave you those. I won't repeat them. But I think the basic interpretation of it is poor Richard and self-reliance in that sense. And I'm not sure it is even a good case of self-reliance. I think even Franklin had a clearer view of his kind of self-reliance than any of us have. Now to me, just the opportunity of getting into a work like this, Scarlet Letter, into a character like Hester or Dimmesdale, that would repay me for the whole term. Now, let me tell you know this. I have had members of my classes always, there's always someone who doesn't like that system. And they come to class and it just hurts them. Everything I say and is done in a class like this, they find it irritates them. And if I could tell ahead of time, I'd warn them so they wouldn't have to suffer. I can't see. Now, there's certain types of people in the university who don't want to use their mind. That wouldn't be right. It'd be sort of petty. But a good many people want to come, let me tell you know this, want to come into a literature course, and they want the instructor to lay it all out, tell you what Swift is like and what Dr. Johnson is like, you see. Just sit back and listen. And I can remember the time that I felt absolutely the same way, and I remember the occasion which came up one time. This marvelous professor, I was in the class, I always felt they're all so smart, I always felt I was in there just by sufferance. And it looked like he knew everything. He had written a concordance of Homer. He not only knew Homer, but he had a concordance. Every word Homer had in all the senses in which Homer used the word. Greek concordance, not English. We were reading Wordsworth at the time, and I thought to myself, what the use is it for me to sit here and talk about Wordsworth when this man knows all about Wordsworth? I must have said something about that one day because I remember his answer. I can remember this. He says, I can't give you my views of Wordsworth. They might differ from yours. He's 50 years old, and I was about 15, 16, 17. I was young. He just couldn't tell me much. But he could open him up. And you see, that's what we can do. We got two basically, radically different points of view. Self-reliance and Emerson's viewpoint, and then the other. Now, you know, you already know, that Hawthorne is not going to write anything to illustrate what Franklin is talking about in self-reliance. You know that. And you can see already that your view of it has been, at least to some extent, the traditional, customary one, which is a reading of Hawthorne in the light of self-reliance. For that matter, we read Emerson's self-reliance and come out of it talking about poor Richard. Now that's done. That's commonly done. Now, what I'm going to ask you to do is the same thing I asked you last time. I'll just restate it. It'll sound different to you now, you see, because you, those times passed, you've thought about it a little bit more. I want you to interpret the scholar letter, or I'd say a little more precisely, Hester Prynne. Interpret Hester, but focus on this third view of Hester. Take about 15 minutes, and that way, you see, you don't have time to use your book. You've already used your books. Interpret Hester largely in the light of this third view of her. Be detailed, you know, just as we were in class last time when we were talking about that second view of her. Thank you. On this one, I'm asking you for interpretation. I want you to use the facts, yes. But it's interpretation. Thank you.